Welcome everybody. Thanks for joining the webinar today. My name is Ashish Bhatia. I'm Program Manager with Azure Machine Learning team, and I drive this learning series. Every other Tuesday we do a learning session. And the session today that we're going to go through is working with large data sets to build predictive models using Azure Machine Learning. We have two very talented individuals with us. Misha Blinko, he's principal researcher at Microsoft. And Girish Natham, he's senior data scientist with the Azure Machine Learning team. Before we jump onto the actual presentation and talk for today, let me quickly point out a few things. The session will be recorded and will be available online. You can kind of consume it on demand on the same link that you received for registration. The slide sets will also be available to you. You will be able to see the slide sets on the resources view on the right side of your screen. We will have 45-15 minutes split, so 45 minutes of talking time and 15 minutes of Q&A. You're free to ask questions at any point of time in the Q&A window that you have. We will pick up questions at the end of the session. We also have Margaret with us, who is again a program manager with the data science team, and we will be answering the questions during the live sessions as well. If some questions are not answered, we encourage you to kind of post those questions on the machine learning forum. You will see a link to the forum again in the resources box on the right side of your screen. And with that, I would then hand it over to Girish for the presentation.
Perfect. Thank you, Ashish. Welcome, everyone. Let me get right to it. So this is the agenda of our presentation. We'll tell you how to work with large data sets. In particular, we'll use the NYC taxi data as a sample data set. I will very quickly walk you through what HD Insight is, which is Microsoft's Hadoop offering on Azure. After that, we will make a segue into IPython notebooks and how to issue Hive queries to an HD Insight cluster from there. This can be frequently useful for visualizing some data, for running some exploratory analyses, before we actually downsample the data for Azure Machine Learning. After this, we will switch gears to build predictive models. Once I give you a quick and dirty intro to Azure Machine Learning Studio, I'll then hand it off to Misha, who will describe this very cool technique called learning with counts, which allows us to build class conditional count features on high cardinality categorical variables. And we will then wrap up this session by showing you an Azure Machine Learning experiment that ties it all together, and also try to point out the benefits of using these count features. Okay, so the sample data is basically NYC taxi. It's essentially a one-year log of NYC taxi rides in the year 2013, and is publicly available. The data set consists of 173 million or so taxi rides, and is 60 gigs unzipped. The data set actually has two parts. There is the trip data, which consists of the driver ID, the pickup and drop-off times, locations in terms of Latlon, and then there is the fare data set, which consists of the fare amount, the tip amount, the tolls amount, the surcharge, and so forth. So in this, in these two tables below, I show you excerpts from the two data sets. The top one is the trip data set, and the one at the bottom is the corresponding fare data set. For the rest of this tutorial, we will look at some data wrangling and then some tip predictions, and then end up. So the tools that we are going to demo to you chiefly will be a brief, like a sort of walkthrough, HD Insight. I'll show you the IPython notebook, and I will demo an experiment on Azure Machine Learning Studio. As for AZ copy, in interest of time, we will not show you any demos, but I would just like to point out that it is an efficient way to copy copy data between Azure Blob Storage or between Blob Storage and a local disk, and it's a parallel copy, so it is frequently quite efficient. Okay, so what is HD Insight? HD Insight is essentially Microsoft's Hadoop offering on Azure. It's 100% Apache Hadoop as an Azure service. The good thing is that we can deploy on Windows or Linux. It, like any other Hadoop service, provides MapReduce capability over big data and Azure blobs. So the first question on everyone's mind must be, okay, how do I commission a cluster? How do I commission a Hadoop or an HD Insight cluster? So let me launch the screen share to take you through that process very quickly. So while this buffers and loads, there we go. Once you have an Azure account and you log into your Manage Windows portal, to create an HD Insight cluster or a Hadoop cluster, all you need to do is to take a look at this elephant icon and click the new button. This gives you the opportunity to custom create an HD Insight cluster. Once you go in here, give it a unique cluster name, choose a subscription name, and then you can choose for advanced Hadoop, advanced MapReduce Hadoop users, a cluster type. You can choose Hadoop, you can choose HBase, or you can choose Storm. The default is Hadoop, as you can see. For the operating system, I'm going to show you what happens with a Windows server in this case. And then you can also choose the HD Insight version. The default is 3.1. You can also choose 3.2, which leads to a Hadoop 2.6 version if that's what you're more comfortable with. So once the cluster is commissioned, what happens is that you can go to the configuration portal of your cluster. In my case, the cluster is called Data Science Process, and you can enable a remote login. This remote login is very useful because it allows us to log into the head node of the cluster. And as I will show you in a second, the head node is the place where we can go and monitor cluster information. We can monitor job progress. For people who prefer to write code from the command line and launch code from there, you can also go ahead and write queries from the Hive REPL off of the head node. So what does the data science process head node look like? It looks exactly like this the first time you log in. You have your cluster name on the top in blue. You have a recycle bin. You have the Hadoop command line. You have a Hadoop name node. And you have the Hadoop yarn status URL. If I look at the Hadoop command line, just resizing this for a convenient view here, you can actually go into the Hive distribution here just by going to the Hive directory and then bin, and then fire up Hive from the command line. This basically takes you to the Hive REPL from where you can launch queries. The other two things of views on the left-hand side here, one is the Hadoop name node. The Hadoop name node is very useful because it gives you your cluster configuration. So for example, as I scroll down here, you will actually see information on the DFS. You'll see how much DFS was used, how much remains, how much of the block pool was used. It also gives you information on the number of live nodes. So we know that this is a 32 node, in this case, 128 core cluster. And there are no dead nodes and no decommissioning nodes. So this is a very useful URL to have because it lets you know what your maximum heap memory is as well and all sorts of cluster configuration details. In addition to this, the Hadoop yarn status URL is very useful because that lets you track the progress of your job application. So as an example, you could go into one of these applications where I seem to have done a select on a column and then done a count by it. You can see the history. This, as you know, gives you a lot of information. It tells you the username, it tells you the state, which is succeeded. In addition to that, for folks who have worked with Hadoop before, you'll also get the average map time, the reduced time, shuffle time, and merge time. And all of these are useful because this allows you to also customize the way you write your jobs if one of these is taking too long or something. So that's the advantage of being able to log into the name node to launch your applications. Let me actually now return back presentation itself for a second while I walk you through IPython notebook, and then I'll show you some examples of how to use the IPython notebook to issue Hive queries. So here we go. So what is the IPython notebook? For folks who don't know, IPython notebook is a web-based Python REPL environment. It combines authoring, execution, visualization, end-to-end machine learning, processing very niftily. You can also write narrative to accompany your experiments so that that can be in sync. It can also author and execute HD Insight Hive queries very simply, as I'll show you in a minute. To get this to work, there's one important thing to remember, is that the IPython notebook needs to be able to access your cluster, which means that the cluster credentials have to be right. So once the cluster credentials are set, then a simple function like submit Hive query will basically allow you to launch a Hive query from the IPython notebook to the HD Insight cluster. And you can also get the results back within the IPython notebook. An example of a query string, the query string could look just like a typical Hive query, which is, for instance, select star from, I'm saying, a sample table, limit 10, which shows you 10 rows of the table. How does this look? Let me take you folks back to a screen share here very quickly to show you what this looks like. While this is buffering, there we go. So I'm going to jump right to the good stuff. In the case of the NYC taxi fare data, one thing of interest is what is the distribution of the tip amounts? How do people tip? Where are the tips peaked? So to do that, Hive has built-in functions. One is histogram numeric, which basically computes the histogram of a column. The number 30 there is the number of bins. And you can also do an explode on that so that you basically render the representation more friendly to the eye. It basically splits up the tuples that Hive generates. So in this case, what I'm doing is I'm basically building a histogram on the tip amount from a table that I already have on my cluster, right? So we can go ahead and just, you know, fire this up. The kernel, if I move over my box here, you see that this circle is blacked out. That's the kernel busy icon that says IPython is doing some processing. While it does it, let me take you to some results. So here, if you took a look at the results, the format is as follows. The X values that we are seeing are the histogram bin centers. The Y value is the histogram count. Since we're in IPython, the nice thing is we can rewrite this for readability. So I'm calling the column as histogram info, retaining the same structure. We might then want to clean this up because one thing of interest might be, hey, the numbers are not giving me a good sense. Can I plot it and take a look? So in the cell that I'm activating now, which is in 8, all we have done is a bit of cleanup to render the data into a tabular format that can be plotted very quickly. So that is the result of doing that. And by then invoking matplotlib to be plotted inline, as I highlight here, we can go ahead and plot the count histogram. So we see here, for example, for the NYC taxi data set that the histogram is peaked at $0. So the tip of $0 is the most prevalent tip. So that's kind of a useful insight to get. I will not show other queries in interest of time, but I will say that you can use IPython notebook in combination with Hive to issue a variety of exploratory data queries on your data. This gives us some insight into how the data is structured. For example, you might want to exclude data that has nulls if columns have a lot of nulls or above a certain threshold. All of these things can, in principle, be done directly from the IPython notebook, and then we can downsample the data for use in Azure Machine Learning. So let me just bring us back to the presentation here real quick. And so here we go. So that was basically a quick and dirty introduction to HD Insight and IPython notebook. Again, if you have questions, please feel free to contact Misha or I at any time after this. Now a quick and dirty introduction to Azure Machine Learning Studio. For those of you who don't know, Azure Machine Learning Studio is a fully managed cloud service. It's a browser-based offering of data flow. So all your machine learning modules, your data entry and data output modules and other things are basically just drag and drop and then connect with arrows. This makes authoring an experiment, tweaking an experiment, and changing an experiment extremely simple. In addition to this, we have the best-in-class machine learning algorithms from MSR, from Bing, Xbox, and so forth. We also have a lot of support for R, Python, and SQL. We believe that by doing this, we cover a whole bunch of data scientists, developers, and also BI engineers. It is extremely simple to write your own R scripts as part of the experiment workflow. So, as also it is to write your own Python scripts. One of the nice things about Azure Machine Learning Studio is that it allows for collaborative data science because there is a versioning mechanism. So when two people are working on an experiment, you can go back and see what changes were made since the last time you ran an experiment. You can also go back to the best version of an experiment should you choose to do so. The one thing we will not have time to get into today in this webinar is that it's also extremely simple to quickly deploy models as web services and REST APIs and then issue calls to those web service APIs. Finally, last but not the least in this case, you can publish to a gallery, publish your experiment to a gallery. This helps other people to know what you're doing, but also allows for community collaboration in building up Azure machine learning experiments. And with that, I will hand it off now to Misha, who will explain this very cool technical learning with counts. And once Misha is done, I will take you through a quick run in Azure Machine Learning Studio where we'll see an experiment that uses the learning with counts features on the NYC taxi dataset. On to you, Misha.
Thanks, Girish. This is Misha, and I'd like to take a brief aside to describe a simple but really powerful technique for scaling up machine learning to a very large transactional dataset, such as the NYC taxi data that Girish introduced. It's called Simply Learning with Counts, and internally we call it Dracula, which those of you who are fans of Sesame Street will hopefully appreciate. So the simple example that I will use to drive it is based on ads for search queries. So it's a good problem because obviously it funds much of the internet as we know it. It's also a really hard machine learning problem for reasons that I'll shortly describe. So when a user enters a search query to a search engine, what the engine needs to figure out is which of the many ads to show. And to do that, it needs to estimate the probability with which a user will click on a given ad at this time, given that they just entered a certain query. The features here are based on attributes of all the entities involved. So the user has attributes such as IP, user ID, the query obviously has text. The context may include, for example, the time of day, while the ad also has IDs, texts of the ad, and so on. So here we have a number of these attributes, and the key issue is that not only this occurs for search, this also occurs for display ads in all other domains as well. And the issue is that there's lots of users. There's lots of users, there's lots of advertisers, there's lots of queries. If we start looking at the numbers, we're talking about billions on each side. And this becomes pretty tricky to convert into numeric features that normal machine learning algorithms like. And just to be clear, the task we're showing here is an information retrieval. And here, this difficulty arises from the fact that we have these entities, such as the item, the page, or the query, the user. Each of them can take on many, many values in terms of IDs or the string attributes they're represented by. But it's not just retrieval, because in other domains, such as fraud or spam or intrusion detection, we also have the same structure where there's entities such as transaction or product or user or recipient or device. And there's many, many, many of them at each time, so the challenge is how to represent this efficiently. So if we look at the classic machine learning scenarios where this problem arises, there's really four requirements on a representation for these high cardinality features that we need to fulfill. So first of all, the representation must be scalable. So it should support representing the signal from billions of attributes and doing it efficiently for data that's stored on distributed systems like Hadoop. That representation needs to be efficient at prediction time, since we're doing many, many predictions per second in some of these domains like ads or fraud. It needs to be flexible in the sense that this representation will go to some downstream learner, boosted trees, nets, perceptron, logistic regression, and we want to experiment with the learner potentially, so we want to be able to change it and, you know, make it more high dimensional, or less high dimensional, higher dimensional, lower dimensional easily. And finally, because things change really fast in this domain, the representation should be adaptive to distribution change. So the standard approaches that people have used here, first of all, binary features, where we just reserve an index in a very high dimensional vector for each unique value, and then we keep them sort of mapping from the original values to the indices. And this obviously doesn't scale because there's just too many items here. Hashing is an interesting follow-up on the technique where instead of the mapping, we just compute a, use a hash function to compute the index for each string value. And that does scale much better. However, there's issues with flexibility because it's now still high dimensional representation. There's also issues with adaptivity because we're not really taking time into account. So that doesn't seem to be quite the best solution. And the solution that we're talking about here, learning with counts, is actually something that has been used in industry quite extensively for a long time. It's been used in online advertising by all the major companies. It's been used in fraud, again, in all sorts of organizations under different names, including, for example, risk tables. And since the technique is pretty old, here what we're doing is we're basically trying to sort of formalize it and generalize it and explain it to you, and as well as show how it can be used in Azure ML. So without further ado, the way it's done is the following. So what we do is that for each attribute of interest, say IP of the user or the name of the advertiser or the combination of the advertiser and the query, we will build a very large table which has every row for each unique value of the attribute, and the columns are simply the class conditional counts or per label statistics. So in this case, we'll count the number of clicks that we've seen in the past for each IP and the number of non-clicks in the two columns. And of course, because the number gets very large, we can't quite keep all those billions in a single table without incurring lots of costs. So typically, we want to compress the tables, which is done by either keeping the head, which is the items with the most counts, and then the tail goes into the single backoff bin called rest here. Alternatives include using sketches, for example, to compress the entire table through hash functions instead of the original keys. But the idea is that we use as much memory as we can to memorize that historical data, and then using that to produce this representation shown below. So based on these two counts, for each of these attributes, we're producing four features. We're producing the raw count of clicks, raw count of non-clicks. The simple transformation is log odds, which basically corresponds to the probability of a click corresponding to those two values. And then also, if we're doing this backoff compression, we also can record whether the value we're looking up is, did we find it, or did we have to go to the backoff, the rest bin, to produce the N plus and N minus. And if those of you familiar with Naive Bayes, the storage is exactly the same as Naive Bayes. We're basically just storing the conditional distribution for each item. The difference is that Naive Bayes, we wouldn't use N plus or N minus or backoff as features. We would simply add up the log odds or multiply the probabilities equivalently. And here, we're using this as a richer representation which will feed to the downstream learner, which actually makes this much more robust. So if we go back to the four requirements that we wanted from a representation, it turns out that this does fulfill all of them. So here, the representation is scalable because as much memory as we have, we will use to memorize the conditional distribution for the head, while the backoff provides us a way to deal with however many new values show up, or sketches allow us to basically use hashing to do the same compression. It's very efficient because it's all we're doing here is just lookups and hashes. And the resulting representation is pretty low dimensional, which will allow us to use strong learners such as boosted trees or neural networks downstream using these values as features. It's pretty flexible because we can now experiment with all sorts of learners, including those that are really unfriendly to a high dimensional space. And finally, we can make the technique adaptive to different temporal changes because we can now store counts, for example, not just for values, but also combine it with time periods, which will allow us to have features which are tied to different times. So to illustrate how this is being used in actual complete workflow, when we think about the time, let's say we're at this T now moment in time right now, and what we do is that the historical data starting from T now, we withhold the immediate period right before T now, and first we can use counting to construct those tables, which is a simple MapReduce process. And the bin function to compute which row every example goes into can be, well, just the identity of the row, so the IP, or we could compute a hash, or we could do custom transformations. For example, for an IP, we could just use the first two bytes and build a different table and use that as a separate feature. We can also do backoff in various ways. So we can use either this REST or Tailbin technique. We could use hashing, or we could even backoff hierarchically, for example, backing off to the first two bytes. A very common technique is just using pseudo counts and smoothing the log odds so that they're more robust. So now that we've built the counts on a large portion of the historical data, we use that remaining portion right before we want to start prediction to train the actual model. And the model will consume features which are driven by the tables, as described earlier. And so here we end up with this, what we're showing here is a single example. And the single example here is formed by, for each of the attributes, going to the table, looking at the counts, and then filling in those features from that table. So we're doing this for each of the tables. And then if we have any additional features, such as, for example, say string similarities, or we have, for example, more historical counts that we just want to fit not from the tables that are not conditional, we can always just add them as well. The key point is that we're still ending up with a fairly low dimensional representation, which allows us to train really powerful learners. And then finally, at prediction time, what we're able to do is we're able to keep on counting over time, basically incrementing the tables with the latest data. So in effect, this makes this an online learning technique because now we're able to incorporate the latest signal into the data. And then the combiner itself does not need to be retrained very often because all it's doing is it's learning how to leverage the different sources of signal that are, you know, captured by the historical statistics on the user, on the query, on the combinations, on all the things we're choosing to count over. So as a result, we have the combiner model that uses the count-based representation that's pretty stable, and then we have the count-based component, which is always absorbing the change in distribution or changes in behavior. So why is this technique so great? Well, first of all, in domains like fraud or ads, the accuracy is king because accuracy is revenue. So the fact that it is the technique of choice for, you know, the companies that spent a lot of resources on improving those components is empirical proof that it does give state-of-the-art accuracy in practice for these very large, very large cardinality problems. It's also convenient because it's a good fit for MapReduce. So doing the counts is a trivial MapReduce exercise. And since data at very large scale tends to now be accessible via MapReduce clusters, it makes it fairly convenient. Pretty importantly, the technique is also modular as opposed to a monolithic approach, like say just using a single feature vector and the large number of weights. Because now we can look at the learner as a system, and then the tables can be monitored, tuned, or we can try adding separate tables and seeing how much they help, versus just having a singular high-dimensional feature vector. Very importantly, in production, the system is monitorable and debuggable. So, for example, if bad things happen, if predictions suddenly start becoming bad, you don't need to worry about. Well, you can either roll to a node or snapshot. Or here, you can just start using tables from an earlier period, or you can see what's going wrong. Is it the counts of the user on certain IPs? Is it accounts from certain domains? You can trace the issue specifically to the pieces that are changing, as opposed to having a large number of parameters that you're just trying to sort of not have them diverge too much. And what this means is that overall, as a system owner, the whole predictor system becomes very straightforward to monitor over time. But also, if you have an emergency, for example, there's a bot attack and you need to remove, say, a bad Thursday from the past. With normal online learning, you can't really do that without sort of retraining from scratch from the beginning and then omitting Thursday. Well, here you can just subtract the counts for Thursday and you've just erased the impact of a bad Thursday. Same goes for, you know, a bad IP that you can just remove from a table. So doing this point-wise surgery on the model becomes possible at runtime, which is pretty unique. The predictions also become decomposable. So when you are unhappy about a certain prediction, you can look at, you know, what are the different features predicting, as opposed to trying to decipher what the weights do. Here you know exactly what the odds based on the user, based on the query, and so on are, which is quite convenient. So with that, I will hand off to Girish, who will show how this technique is available in Azure ML through a couple of modules. and he will demonstrate on the NYC taxi data how it can be used to train from a very large amount of data fairly easily. Girish?
Cool. Thanks, Misha. So, hi again, everyone. What I'll now show you, because we have some time, is I will give you a quick tour of the Azure Machine Learning Studio, just in terms of how things are located, the data sets, the modules, and stuff like that. Then I will introduce the count-specific modules, the build count table module and the count featurizer module. And after that, I will show you an experiment. So let me just launch the screen share here real quick. While that buffers. Right. So when you log in to Azure Machine Learning Studio and create a new experiment, the left panel is the interesting stuff initially. We have saved data sets. This is a bunch of data sets. There are public data sets like adult census. Any data set that you save in Azure Machine Learning also resides here. So this is a good resource for picking up data sets for building models. If you save any trained models, any trained model parameters, they typically reside in the trained models section. Then we have data format conversions. So you can convert to ARFF, you can convert to CSV. If you need a data set that sits natively within Azure ML, you can convert to data set itself. You can also convert to SVM Lite and convert to TSV. So this is a fairly big array of conversion formats that we allow. As far as data input output go, you have the reader and the writer that you'll most commonly use. The reader can take data from a data set. It can take data using a Hive query. For example, if I just brought the reader one here just for a second, it can take data that's sitting in Azure blob storage or a web URL or a Hive query, SQL database or an Azure table. So that's a fairly rich set of data that it can consume. For data transformation, we have filters, which basically are FIR, IR, median filters, moving average, and so on. The learning width counts, which I'll go into in more detail in a second. And then there's a whole bunch of data manipulation, like you can add columns and rows, you can clean missing data, you can group categorical values, you can project columns out, you can remove duplicate rows, and so on. By invoking something like the sample and split module, you can do partition and sample, and you can also split. So you can partition the data based on certain keys. You can also split the data. For example, that's a very common use case where you want to have 75% of the data go for training, and maybe 25% for test, or 75% training, 10% test, and let's say 15% for validation. And then there's a whole bunch of machine learning stuff. So you can do feature selection. You have a slew of machine learning models like I talked about. You can evaluate models. You have scoring models where you can score the model and get scores. You have training where you can do parameter sweeps. And also you have a whole bunch of other things that I will not have time to go into, but for instance, Python language modules, R language modules, a whole slew of statistics functions, text analytics, and so on. So let me focus on two modules that are important for our experiment here. One is the build count table module. So the build count table module basically is the module that we use to build count tables on the high cardinality categorical features. Sorry about that. So what does it take as input? It takes a number of classes, because remember that these are class conditional counts, like Misha said. You can give the number of bits for the hash function. That gives you the number of bins that you can choose for dropping your hashed values into 2 to the b bins for b bits. For reproducible experiments, it's advisable to use a given seed. The good thing about the module is it can consume data from various types. It can consume a data set that sits natively in Azure ML. You can consume data from a blob. You can also consume data using a MapReduce functionality where, like Misha was pointing out, the build count table module launches a quick MapReduce job to compute the count tables. Most of the features here that I'm glossing over are basically credentials. The interesting stuff comes down below, where we have to specify two things. We need to specify the index of the columns we want to count on. Usually these are high cardinality categorical columns. And then we need to specify the column that contains the class labels. Again, why do we need to do that? Because we are building class conditional counts. But once the count table is built, that's half the stuff. We also need to incorporate these count features as features into our training and test data. To do that, we have the count featurizer module. So here we select the counted columns that I'm showing in blue. You can also select the columns to featurize on, as a subset of those are all the columns. And then there are some advanced options here. You have a garbage bin threshold that says, hey, if I have less than 10 examples, then, for example, ignore it. You can set the number as you like. You can also do smoothing using some prior pseudo examples. And in the output features, we have a way in which you can say you would like both the counts and the log odds. Now, again, remember the counts are the raw counts. So n plus was the raw counts of the positive class, n minus of the negative class, and the log odds was log of n plus minus log of n minus. So in the output features, we can choose to have just the counts, just the log odds, or both the count and the log odds. In addition to that, the user has flexibility on what to do with the back-off column. So the back-off column, as you remember, was where the tail of the distribution sat. And you can choose to ignore it if you like, or you can choose to have it as part of the feature set. Now let me jump right into showing you a pre-prepared experiment demo of using count features on the NYC taxi data. So let me just blow this up a little bit for ease of showing it to folks. This experiment is fairly straightforward. On the left-hand side, we basically have the experiment that uses count features. Sorry about that. Screen is a bit unresponsive. So what I've done here is that I pre-prepared a count table in interest of time, and that allows us to go visualize what the count table looks like for this problem. So we can see that the count table typically has a column index, which is the column you counted on, the hash function, the hash value, and there are five classes here. Let me just give a minute's preamble here on why there are five classes. We wanted to build a multi-class classification model that, given the features, for example, the driver features, the lat-lon locations, the pickup time, would then predict into which bin a tip would fall. And the bins we divided were so forth. We had $0 as being class 0. The reason for that was simple. As we looked in the exploratory analysis, about 47% of the tips were 0, so it kind of makes sense to give $0 its own class. Then greater than $0 and less than $5 was class 1. Between $5 and $10 was class 2. $10 to $20 was class 3. And greater than $20 was class 4. That explains the five classes, right? In addition to the count table, we also have a count table metadata. That is right here. And let me just quickly visualize that for you folks. So the metadata basically has information on what the settings were that you used to build the count table. For instance, I used 24 bits in the hash function. The hash seed was 1, 2, 3. Number of classes were 5. Did we load from a blob? In this case, no. The count table type, which I didn't get into, but Misha touched upon a fair amount, was that there are two types we can build. We can build a dictionary, and we can also build a compact representation called the count min sketch. So in this case, I built a dictionary. And finally, we have information on which columns we counted on, which was the 1, 2, 3, which in this case happens to be the driver features, and 11, 12, 13, which happens to be the pickup coordinates, pickup drop-off lat-lon coordinates. The right side of the experiment is exactly the same train and test data, but without using count features. And what I want to show you very quickly by running this experiment is, do we get any benefit by using count features or by using the learning with counts method to build class conditional counts on the high cardinality categorical variables? So let me go ahead and run this. Hopefully it should run very quickly because it's already in cache. And again, that's for interest of time. So once this runs, what we will try to compare is the confusion matrices from using the count features and the confusion matrix from not using the count features. And hopefully I'll be able to convince you that there is some use of using count features. There is an advantage to using it, especially for the rarer classes. So let's take a look here now. The evaluate model visualize gives us an opportunity to take a look at the confusion matrix. The confusion matrix on the left is what was predicted using the data that had count features. On the right is the case where we did not use comp features. Now, one other thing by way of preamble, if we looked at this data, it turns out that about 96% of the data is actually in class 0 and class 1. So people based 96% of the writes were tipped between $0 and $5. And class 2, 3, and 4 are definitely the rarer classes. Now, what happens without using count features is typically that for the rarer classes, since you have less data to train and learn from, the high dimensionality of the categorical features means that there's a high variance model. And this is actually shown when we compare the accuracies. If you look at the accuracies for class 2, 3, and 4, the model that uses count features uniformly does better. You have 71.1 against 68.9, you have 75.9 against 73.8, and 13.1 against 11.1. The class 4 is extremely low accuracy, and that's to be expected because that corresponds to a tip of greater than $20, and there's an extremely small fraction of people who actually tip that high. But if you look for the more prevalent classes, 0 and 1, there's a lot of data to train from, we don't see as much of a difference between using comp features and not. So what the comp features buy us is very comparable, similar performance on the prevalent classes, but better performance on the rarer classes because they reduce the variance in the estimates. So I hope that ties up our story of HD Insight, how to use Azure Machine Learning Studio, and in particular, how to use Azure Machine Learning Studio and the Learning with Count, so the Build Count Table modules, to build class conditional count features on the high cardinality categorical variables, and how to run experiments of this kind. So let me now actually stop the screen share and take you folks back to the slides. Here we are. So like I just said a minute back, in putting it all together, the key things here to remember are that HD Insight is Microsoft's Hadoop as an Azure service offering. It allows for large data storage and MapReduce processing very conveniently. When you commission a cluster for free, you get Hive and Pig installed. You can also, by using a PowerShell script, equally easily install an Anaconda Python distribution, R, or whatever else you want. Azure Machine Learning is our cloud machine learning and analytics, which is accessible anywhere where you have a browser and resources in the cloud. It has a versioning system that allows for collaborative data science. It also allows you to publish experiments to the gallery, which results in community collaboration, and therefore more and more better examples getting added to the gallery. And finally, we looked at this very cool technique that Misha told us about, which is called learning with counts for building class conditional count features on high cardinality, high dimensionality categorical variables. It's very intuitive, it's very robust, it's very easy to recover from quote-unquote catastrophic events, like, for example, you talked about a bot attack, by just quote-unquote erasing the relevant counts that correspond to that. And also it's extremely flexible, and because it is low cost and low dimensionality, it's scalable as a large-scale machine learning solution. And at the end of this, thanks for your time. Thank you for taking the time to listen to Misha and I. There are a few useful links that we have for you here, how to sign up for a free Azure Machine Learning trial, also a free tutorial on how to use Azure Machine Learning. If you need help with using Azure Machine Learning for teaching in a classroom, please don't hesitate to contact Misha or I. Our email addresses are at the bottom of the slide. If you have any other questions related to the content of the webinar or with Azure Machine Learning as such, please feel free to contact us, and now we'll be happy to take questions. Over to you, Ashish.
Thanks, Girish and Misha. Let me pick up some questions in the Q&A window. First question is, how does count feature help classifying items into rarer classes?
Our rare classes is a hard case because, as if you recall, the number of columns corresponds to the number of classes, or if you're doing a numeric prediction, you will need to discretize it. So with rare classes, that does not really help directly because it means that if you have many classes, you will need to have corresponding counts. That said, if you don't have too many classes, you have just a really uneven distribution, what happens is then for those classes, you are maintaining the information directly about them, and then it's up to the combiner to basically leverage it more effectively. But the key thing is that it's basically it's keeping the evidence for those classes intact, and then it's up to the combiner model to make good use of it.
Thanks, Nisha. The next question is, if you're using deep, say 16 layers and orderly wide neural network, what is a good way to estimate how long it will take? How long do you have to wait for the service to finish training?
To use, I don't know, every neural network's practitioner's favorite term is black art. So in general, I mean, because there's multiple factors there, so it's a question of how sparse the connections. I mean, you can always use things like dropout in the intermediate layers. In general, I would say 16 layers is pretty extreme, especially if it's fully connected. My default advice would be to try boosted trees. But in general, I think the rule of thumb, when you're adding, the way to think of it conceptually is that when you're adding a layer, it's all about the layer and the layers above and below, because that's the number of new connections you're adding is the product. So that's where the algebra you want to run through your head is that the cost is roughly proportional to the number of connections, since that's, those are the things you have to update on every example. So that's going to be the question, is that how it can be 16 layers, but if it's really, needless to say, some layers are thick and some are thin. Wide, I think, is the key word here, is because it's the width that's now, it's wide squared times 16, that is your number of parameters.
Thanks, Misha. A couple of questions around bringing in data into Azure Machine Learning. Let me ask this to Gish. Gish, the user is asking, how do you bring in data into Azure Machine Learning? Do you upload them, or can it be connected to enterprise data source inside a company firewall? There was another question around bringing in data from Amazon S3.
Okay. So let me answer the first part first. So to bring data into Azure Machine Learning, you can use the simplest way would be to downsample it so that it fits within the 10 gig limit that we have right now. And then you can actually use a reader module to bring in the data like I showed from various sources. You can have a web, you can have web access via HTTP, you can have Azure Blob Storage, you could have a data set sitting in Azure Machine Learning. To upload a data set, for instance, a data set which is in Azure Machine Learning, the simplest way would be if you have data sitting locally, you can actually just upload that data set in your Azure Machine Learning workspace. That basically saves the data as a data set for you to be able to use. Right now, I guess we do have the requirement that the data has to be on the cloud. So within inside a company firewall is not something that we can access, because you, even if the data sits locally for you on your desktop, you will have to upload it to Azure or Azure Blob Storage before you can actually start using it. As far as the second question of how to get data directly from S3, I am not aware of any tool that directly brings data from S3 to Azure. The recommended method that I have tried and that I've seen work pretty well is to use S3 CMD to get the data to local storage, and then AZ copy to move it from local storage to a blob or within blobs after that. So that it would be a two-step process, but I've actually tried this on a few hundred gigs of data and it works fairly well. I don't know of a single tool that will get it directly from S3 to Azure at this point.
Thanks, Girish. Another question related to storage. I have data in Azure Storage. I process this data using HD Insight and place data in a Hive table. How can I connect this Hive table to Azure ML?
Right. So there are a couple of ways you can do this. When you process data and populate a Hive table, Hive automatically generates a directory structure that is Hive/warehouse/database name/table name. So you can directly access this using the reader module, and in the reader module giving the Hive query option. That allows you to run Hive queries off of your table. You can also potentially access the table just as a data file. So not as a table, but as a data file, by looking at it as being just stored in Azure Blob Storage and giving the full path to the data. So there are two ways of doing it. If you prefer issuing a Hive query, then you can use a Hive query to connect to the table. And if you just want to bring the data and it's the right size for Azure Machine Learning, then you can regard it as just being an Azure Blob Storage and give this full path, which is Hive slash warehouse slash database name slash table name slash whatever file name, and you can also process it that way.
Thanks, Girish. Let me pick up one more question. In an online streaming environment, you could constantly get unseen categorical values, which would not be in countable at the time of scoring. Do you have a mechanism to add them on fly, or you have to retrain the whole system? Misha, you want to take that?
So there's no need. Yeah, I'll take that. So there's no need to retrain the whole system. So there's two scenarios. So one is if you're using the dictionary table with a back off. With unseen values, what will happen is that they will basically be going into the picking up values from the rest or garbage bin from the back off. And then the assumption with dictionary with the dictation is that there is a separate process which periodically updates which rows are constituting the head. So in that periodic process, those will get picked up. That's one possibility. If you're using countmin sketches, then everything happens organically because there is no thing such a backoff bin. As soon as you start, you know, whatever the cells that the new value is mapping to, they'll get incremented. That's the one benefit of countmin sketches is that the whole new value process is completely organic, and then there's no need for retraining or anything.
Thanks, Mish, again. Kirish, maybe this one for you. Can Data Factory easily interact with Azure ML?
Sure. Let me preface this. If it's Azure Data Factory that the person is referring to, then it's actually fairly straightforward to set up a pipeline where ADF can interact with Azure ML. We've actually already done that internally in the group, and this actually works pretty well because in addition to be able to move large amounts of data around, ADF can also be used as a scheduler. So you can also schedule data pipelines to move at a certain time and also pick up data and then process it and then maybe downsample and then process within Azure ML at certain times of the day. So yes, certainly Data Factory, like an Azure Data Factory, can be configured to interact programmatically with Azure Machine Learning.
Thanks, Girish. Another question, can aggregate sum be done likewise apart from aggregate count?
I'm not sure I quite understand the question. So aggregate sum likewise apart from aggregate count. By aggregate count, I assume what is meant is that if you're doing MapReduce, then you know the reduction is doing the aggregation of the counts across the different shards. But I'm not sure I understand. I guess if the sum here means the sum of overall, I guess you certainly can do the overall prior estimation
right.
The same way.
Okay, I'll move to the next question, Misha. Then, can we count and train on the same data set?
Can we count on? Which one is it? This is, can we count on the same on, and train? Yes. Okay. So that's a great question. It's hard. It turns out that if you just do it blindly, you will leak the labels from the trains from the counts into the train set. So by default, that's why when I presented, I did kind of the sure thing to do is to separate the two. However, one cool technique that we've developed is something based on this area theory called differential privacy. In the module, there's a parameter called Laplacian noise. By increasing this parameter, what this allows doing is this exactly allows to reuse the same data set for both counting and training because the parameter controls, if you can think of it as sort of slightly corrupting the counts to ensure that no label leakage is occurring. I think the rule of thumb for all these things is always keep a validation data set and be really on guard for overfitting. Because that's where if you don't use noise or if you use insufficient noise, you could leak data, leak labels and overfit. That's a very good question.
Sure, thanks. One more question. Is learning with count kind of new technique, or has this been used before?
It's pretty old. It's a couple decades old. So in the last decade, all the ad companies now use it as their sort of standard production infrastructure for click prediction. In fraud, this has been used for a couple of decades now under various names such as risk tables, where it is sort of the most common approach to doing fraud transaction processing. And then before that, there were references to like compiler branch prediction using a very similar technique, so it's not new by any means. Very much tried
it. All right, thanks. I'll pick up probably one last question. How are the raw counts smoothened?
How are the raw counts smoothed? So to smooth the raw counts, the basic technique is known as Laplace smoothing, where you add a number of pseudo counts, and then you use the overall class prior to compute the ratio of pseudo counts for the two classes. But that's the default. There's, again, a parameter in the module, in the featureizer module, which controls how much smoothing is being done. And that's something worth experimenting with.
Sure. So we almost at the hour. Misha and Girish, thanks a lot for an informative session. It was very interactive. For everybody else, we will be sharing the slides and the recording in a follow-up email to you folks. This is, as I mentioned, an ongoing learning series. Every other Tuesday, we have a new topic and a new speaker. So join us again in 2 weeks' time. Follow us on Twitter at ML at Microsoft, and we will be making these webinar announcements on that Twitter handle. Have a great day, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Bye for now.